Chapter 19. Tangerine of Mindfulness. When Sujata brought Siddhartha's food that noon, she found him sitting beneath the pipala tree, as beautiful as a young morning. His face and body radiated peace, joy, and equanimity. She had seen him sitting solemnly and majestically beneath the pipala tree over 100 times, yet today there was something different about him. Looking at Siddhartha, Sujata felt all her sorrows and worries vanish. Happiness as fresh as a spring breeze filled her heart. She felt there was nothing else she needed or wanted on this earth, that everything in the universe was already good and beneficial, and that no one needed to worry or despair anymore. Sujata took a few steps forward and placed the food before Siddhartha. She bowed before him. She felt the peace and joy within Siddhartha enter herself. Siddhartha smiled at her and said, "Here, sit down with me. I thank you for bringing me food and water these past months. Today is the happiest day of my life, because last night I found the great way. Please enjoy this happiness too. In the near future, I will go teach this path to all others." Sujata looked up with surprise. "You will be going? You mean you will leave us?" Siddhartha smiled kindly. "Yes, I must leave, but I won't abandon you, children. Before I leave, I will show you the path I've discovered." Sujata was not very reassured. She wanted to ask him more, but he spoke first. "I will remain with you children for at least several more days in order to share what I have learned with you. Only then will I take to the road. But that doesn't mean I will be apart from you forever. From time to time, I will return to visit you children." Sujata felt comforted. She sat down and opened the banana leaf to reveal the offering of rice. She sat silently at Siddhartha's side as he ate. She watched as he broke off pieces of rice and dipped them in sesame salt. Her heart was filled with inexpressible happiness. When he finished eating, Siddhartha asked Sujata to return home. He said he wanted to meet with the village children that afternoon in the forest. Many children came, including Svasti's brother and sisters. The boys had all bathed and put on clean clothes. The girls wore their loveliest saris. Sujata's sari was ivory-colored. Nandabala wore a sari the color of banana shoots, and Bhimi's sari was pink. The children, looking as fresh and colorful as flowers, sat around Siddhartha beneath the pipala tree. Sujata brought a basket full of coconut and chunks of palm sugar as a special treat. The children scooped out the tasty coconut meat and ate it with the delicious sugar. Nandabala and Subhash brought a basketful of tangerines. Siddhartha sat with the children, his happiness complete. Rupak offered him a chunk of coconut with a piece of palm sugar on a pipala leaf. Nandabala offered him a tangerine. Siddhartha accepted their offerings and ate with the children. They were still enjoying their lunch when Sujata made an announcement. "Dear friends, today is the happiest day our teacher has ever known. He has discovered the great way. I feel this is also a very important day for me. Brothers and sisters, let us consider this a day of great jubilation for us all. We are here today to celebrate the enlightenment of our teacher. Respected teacher, the great path has been found. We know you cannot stay with us forever. Please teach us the things you think we might be able to understand." Sujata joined her palms together and bowed to Gautama to express her respect and devotion. Nandabala and the other children also joined their palms and bowed with deepest sincerity. Siddhartha quietly gestured for the children to sit back up, and he said, "You are all intelligent children, and I am sure you'll be able to understand and practice the things I will share with you. The great path I have discovered is deep and subtle, but anyone willing to apply his or her heart and mind can understand and follow it. When you children peel a tangerine, you can eat it with awareness or without awareness. What does it mean to eat a tangerine in awareness? When you're eating the tangerine, you are aware that you're eating the tangerine. You fully experience its lovely fragrance and sweet taste. When you peel the tangerine, you know that you are peeling the tangerine. When you remove a slice and put it in your mouth, you know that you are removing a slice and putting it in your mouth. When you experience the lovely fragrance and sweet taste of the tangerine, You are aware that you are experiencing the lovely fragrance and sweet taste of the tangerine. The tangerine Nandavala offered me had 9 sections. I ate each morsel in awareness, and saw how precious and wonderful it was. I did not forget the tangerine, and thus the tangerine became something very real to me. If the tangerine is real, the person eating it is real. That is what it means to eat a tangerine in awareness. Children, what does it mean to eat a tangerine without awareness? When you're eating the tangerine, you do not know that you are eating the tangerine. You do not experience the lovely fragrance and sweet taste of the tangerine. When you peel the tangerine, you do not know that you are peeling the tangerine. When you remove a slice and put it in your mouth, you do not know that you are removing a slice and putting it in your mouth. When you smell the fragrance or taste the tangerine, you do not know that you are smelling the fragrance and tasting the tangerine. Eating a tangerine in such a way, you cannot appreciate its precious and wonderful nature. If you are not aware that you are eating the tangerine is not real. If the tangerine is not real, the person eating it is not real either. Children, that is eating a tangerine without awareness. Children, eating the tangerine in mindfulness means that while eating the tangerine, you are truly in touch with it. Your mind is not chasing after thoughts of yesterday or tomorrow, but is dwelling fully in the present moment. The tangerine is truly present. Living in mindful awareness means to live in the present moment, your mind and body dwelling in the very here and now. A person who practices mindfulness can see things in the tangerine that others are unable to see. An aware person can see the tangerine tree, the tangerine blossom in the spring, the sunlight and rain that nourish the tangerine. Looking deeply, one can see 10,000 things that have made the tangerine possible. Looking at a tangerine, a person who practices awareness can see all the wonders of the universe and how all things interact with one another. Children, our daily life is just like a tangerine. Just as a tangerine is comprised of sections, each day is comprised of 24 hours. 1 hour is like 1 section of tangerine. Living all 24 hours of a day is like eating all the sections of a tangerine. The path I have found is the path of living each hour of the day in awareness, mind and body always dwelling in the present moment. The opposite is to live in forgetfulness. If we live in forgetfulness, we do not know that we are alive. We do not fully experience life because our mind and body are not dwelling in the here and now. Gautama looked at Sujata and said her name. "Yes, teacher," Sujata joined her palms. "Do you think a person who lives in awareness will make many errors or few?" "Respected teacher, a person who lives in awareness will make few errors. My mother always tells me that a girl should pay attention to how she walks, stands, speaks, laughs, and works in order to avoid thoughts, words, and actions that might cause sorrow to herself or others." "Just so, Sujata. A person who lives in awareness knows what she is thinking, saying, and doing. Such a person can avoid thoughts, words, and actions that cause suffering for herself and others." Children, living in awareness means to live in the present moment. One is aware of what is taking place within oneself and in one's surroundings. One is in direct contact with life. If one continues to live in such a way, one will be able to deeply understand oneself and one's surroundings. Understanding leads to tolerance and love. When all beings understand one another, they will accept and love one another. Then there will not be much suffering in the world. What do you think, Svasti? Can people love if they are unable to understand? Respected teacher, without understanding, love is most difficult. It reminds me of something that happened to my sister Bhima. One night she cried all night long until my sister Bala lost her patience and spanked Bhima. That only made Bhima cry more. I picked Bhima up and sensed that she was feverish. I was sure her head ached from the fever. I called Bala and told her to place her hand on Bhima's forehead. When she did that, she understood at once why Bhima was crying. Her eyes softened, and she took Bhima into her arms and sang to her with love. Bhima stopped crying even though she still had a fever. Respected teacher, I think that was because Bala understood why Bhima was upset. And so I think that without understanding, love is not possible. Just so, Svasti. Love is possible only when there is understanding. And only with love can there be acceptance. Practice living in awareness, children, and you will deepen your understanding. You will be able to understand yourselves, other people, and all things, and you will have hearts of love. That is the wonderful path I have discovered. Svasti joined his palms. Respected teacher, could we call this the path of awareness? Siddhartha smiled. Surely, we can call it the path of awareness. I like that very much. The path of awareness leads to perfect awakening. Sujata joined her palms to ask permission to speak. You are the awakened one, the one who shows how to live in awareness. Can we call you the awakened one? Siddhartha nodded. That would please me very much. Sujata's eyes shone. She continued. Awaken in Mugadi is pronounced Bud. A person who is awakened would be called Buddha in Mugadi. We can call you Buddha. Siddhartha nodded. All the children were delighted. 14-year-old Nalaka, the oldest boy in the group, spoke. Respected Buddha, we are very happy to receive your teaching on the path of awareness. Sujata has told me how you have meditated beneath this pipala tree for the past 6 months and how just last night you attained the great awakening. Respected Buddha, this pipala tree is the most beautiful one in all the forest. Can we call it the tree of awakening? The Bodhi tree? The word Bodhi shares the same root as the word Buddha and also means awakening. Gautama nodded his head. He was delighted too. He had not guessed that during this gathering with the children, the path, himself, and even the great tree would all receive special names. Nandabala joined his palms. It is growing dark, and we must return to our homes, but we will come back to receive more of your teaching soon. The children all stood and joined their palms like lotus buds to thank the Buddha. They strolled home, chattering like a flock of happy birds. The Buddha was happy too. He decided to stay in the forest for a longer period of time in order to explore ways to best sow the seeds of awakening and to allow himself as well special time to enjoy the great peace and joy that attaining the path had brought him. Chapter 20. The Deer. Every day the Buddha bathed in the Niranjara River. He did walking meditation along the riverbanks and along the small forest paths his own steps had created. He sat in meditation on the shore beside the flowing river or beneath the Bodhi tree while hundreds of birds chirped among its branches. He had realized his vow. He knew he must return to Kapilavatu, where so many awaited news of his quest. He recalled as well King Bimbisara in the city of Rajagaha. He felt a special affinity for the young king and wished to visit him also. There were also his 5 former companions. He knew they each possessed the ability to attain liberation quickly, and he wanted to find them. No doubt they still dwelled nearby. River, sky, moon, and stars, mountains, forest, every blade of grass and every mote of dust were transformed for the Buddha. He knew that the long years he wandered in search of the way had not been wasted. Indeed, thanks to his trials and hardships, he had finally discovered the way in his own heart. Every living being possessed the heart of enlightenment. The seeds of enlightenment existed in everyone. Living beings did not need to seek enlightenment outside of themselves because all the wisdom and strength of the universe was already present in them. This was the Buddha's great discovery and was cause for all to rejoice. The children came to visit him often. The Buddha was happy to see that the way of liberation could be expressed simply and naturally. Even poor country children who had never attended school could understand his teaching. This greatly encouraged him. One day the children arrived with a basket full of tangerines. They wanted to eat the tangerines in awareness in order to practice the very first lesson the Buddha had taught them. Sujata bowed gracefully before the Buddha and then held the basket before him. He joined his palms together like a lotus bud and took a tangerine. Sujata offered the basket to Svasti, who was sitting by the Buddha's side. He, too, joined his palms together and took a tangerine. She offered the basket to each child until everyone had a tangerine. She sat down and placed her palms together before taking a tangerine for herself. All the children sat silently. The Buddha told them to follow their breath and smile. Then he lifted his tangerine in his left hand and looked deeply at it. The children followed his example. He slowly peeled his tangerine, and the children began to peel theirs. Teacher and students enjoyed their tangerines in silent awareness. When everyone was finished eating, Bala gathered up the peels. The children had greatly enjoyed eating their tangerines mindfully with the Buddha. The Buddha took great pleasure in sharing such a practice with the children. The children visited the Buddha in the afternoons. He showed them how to sit still and to follow their breath in order to calm their minds when they felt sad or angry. He taught them walking meditation to refresh their minds and bodies. He taught them to look deeply at others and at their own actions in order to be able to see, to understand, and to love. The children understood all he taught them. Namdabala and Sujata spent an entire day sewing a new robe to offer the Buddha. It was the color of bricks, similar to the cloth of the Buddha's old robe. When Sujata learned he had to take the cemetery cloth used to cover the corpse of her former household servant Radha, who had died of typhoid fever, she wanted to weep. The Buddha was sitting beneath the Bodhi tree when the two girls arrived to offer him the robe. They waited quietly for him to emerge from his meditation. When they presented him with the new robe, he was very happy. "I have need of this robe," he said. He told them he would keep the old cloth as well, in order to have something to wear whenever he washed his new robe. Namdabala and Sujata privately resolved to sew him another robe soon. One day, Sujata's 12-year-old girlfriend, Balagupta, asked the Buddha to speak to them about friendship. Just the day before, Balagupta had had an argument with her closest friend, Jatilika. She had not wanted to stop by Jatilika's house on her way to see the Buddha the following day, and only did so at Sujata's insistence. Jatilika only agreed to join them because Sujata was there. When the girls arrived at the Bodhi tree, Balagupta and Jatilika sat far apart from one another. The Buddha told the children about the friendship shared by a deer, a bird, and a turtle. He told them that the story had taken place several thousand years before, when he was a deer in a past life. The children looked surprised, but he explained, "In previous lives we have all been earth, stones, dew, wind, water, and fire. We have been mosses, grasses, trees, insects, fish, turtles, birds, and mammals. I have seen this most clearly in my meditations. Thus, in one life I was a deer. This is quite an ordinary thing. I can still remember a life in which I was a jagged rock upon a mountain peak, and another life in which I was a plumeria tree. It is the same for all of you. The story I am going to tell you is about a deer, a bird, a turtle, and a hunter. Perhaps one of you was the bird, and another the turtle. We have all existed in times when there were not yet any humans, or even birds and mammals on Earth. There were only plants beneath the seas, and trees and vegetation on the earth's surface. In those times we may have been stones, dew, or plants. Afterward we experienced lives as birds, as all kinds of animals, and finally as human beings. Right now we are more than just human beings. We are rice plants, tangerines, rivers, and air, because without these things we could not be. When you children look at rice plants, coconuts, tangerines, and water, remember that in this life you depend upon many other beings for your existence. These other beings are part of you. If you can see that, you will experience true understanding and love. Although the story I'm about to tell you took place several thousand years ago, it could just as easily take place this very moment. Listen carefully and see whether or not you have something in common with the animals in this story." Then the Buddha began to tell his tale. At that time, the Buddha was a deer, who lived in a forest that had a clear lake where the deer liked to drink. A turtle lived in the lake's waters, and a magpie lived in the branches of a willow tree beside the lake. Deer, turtle, and magpie were very close friends. One day, a hunter followed day-old tracks left by deer that led to the edge of the lake. There he left a trap made of strong ropes before returning to his hut on the outskirts of the forest. Later that day, when deer came to the lake for a drink of water, he was caught by the trap. He cried out and was heard by turtle and magpie. Turtle crawled out of the water, and magpie flew down from her nest. They discussed how best to help their friend get out of his predicament. Magpie said, "Sister Turtle, your jaws are sturdy and strong. You can use them to chew and cut through these ropes. As for me, I'll find a way to prevent the hunter from coming back here." Magpie then flew off in haste. Turtle began to gnaw at the ropes. Magpie flew to the hunter's hut and perched on a mango branch outside his front door all night to wait for him. When day broke, the hunter took a sharp knife and walked out his door. As soon as she saw him, Magpie flew into his face with all her might. Struck in the face by the bird, the hunter was momentarily dazed and went back inside his hut. He lay down on the bed to rest a moment. When he got up, he paused for a moment, and then, still clutching his sharp knife, went out the back door of his hut. But clever Magpie had outguessed him. She was waiting at the back, perched on a jackfruit branch. Again she flew into his face, smacking him hard. Struck in the face twice by a bird, the hunter went back into his house to think things over. He decided it was an unlucky day, and that perhaps it would be best to remain home until the morrow. The next morning he rose early. He picked up his sharp knife, and as a precaution, covered his face with a hat before he walked out the door. Seeing she could no longer attack the hunter's face, Magpie sped back to the forest to warn her friends. "The hunter is on his way!" Turtle had almost chewed through the last of the ropes, but the last rope seemed as hard as steel. Her jaws were raw and bloody from chewing non-stop throughout 2 nights and a day. Still, she did not stop. Just then, the hunter appeared. Frightened, Deer gave a mighty kick, which broke through the last rope and set him free. Deer ran into the forest. Magpie flew high into the willow tree. But Turtle was so exhausted from her efforts that she could not move. The hunter was angry to see the deer escape. He picked up the turtle and tossed her in his leather sack, which he left hanging on a branch of the willow tree. Then he went off to find Deer. Deer stood concealed behind some bushes and so saw Turtle's predicament. "My friends risked their lives for me," he thought. "Now it is time for me to do the same for them." Deer stepped out in full view of the hunter. He pretended to stumble as though very tired, and then he turned away and hobbled weakly down the path. The hunter thought, "The deer is almost out of strength. I will stalk it and soon kill it with my knife." The hunter pursued Deer deeper and deeper into the forest. Deer managed to stay just out of the hunter's reach. When they were far from the lake, Deer suddenly broke into a run until he was out of the hunter's sight. He covered his hoof prints and then returned to the lake. He used his antlers to lift the leather bag off the branch and to shake Turtle out. Magpie joined her two friends. "You both saved me from sure death today at the hunter's hand," said Deer. "I fear he will return here before long. Magpie, fly to a safer spot in the forest. Sister Turtle, crawl back into the water and hide. I will run back into the forest." When the hunter arrived back at the lake, he found his leather sack on the ground empty. Frustrated, he picked it up and, still clutching his knife, trudged home. The children had listened to the Buddha's tale with wide-eyed interest. When the Buddha described how raw and bloody Turtle's jaws had become from chewing the ropes to save her friend, Rupak and Subhash almost cried. The Buddha asked the children, "What do you think, children? Long ago I was Deer. Were any of you Turtle?" 4 children raised their hand, including Sujata. The Buddha then asked, "And who among you is Magpie?" Svasti raised his hand, as did Jatilika and Balagupta. Sujata looked at Jatilika and then at Balagupta. "If you were both Magpie, that makes you one person. What good is it for Magpie to be mad at Magpie? Can't our friendship equal that of magpie, turtle, and deer? Balagupta stood up and walked over to Jatilika. She took her friend's hand in her own two hands. Jatilika pulled Balagupta into her arms and then slid over to make a place for Balagupta to sit. The Buddha smiled. You children understand the story well. Remember that tales like the one I have just recounted are taking place all the time, right in our own daily lives. Chapter 21. The Lotus Pond. After the children returned home, the Buddha did walking meditation. He lifted his robe to wade across the river and then followed a path between two rice fields that led to a lotus pond he liked very much. There he sat down and contemplated the beautiful lotuses. As he looked at the lotus stems, leaves, and flowers, he thought of all the different stages of a lotus's growth. The roots remained buried in the mud. Some stems had not risen above the surface of the water, while others had barely emerged to reveal leaves still curled tightly shut. There were unopened lotus flower buds, those with petals just beginning to peek out, and lotus flowers in full bloom. There were seed pods from which all the petals had fallen. There were white lotus flowers, blue ones, and pink ones. The Buddha reflected that people were not very different from lotus flowers. Each person had his or her own natural disposition. Devadatta was not like Ananda. Yasodhara was not the same as Queen Pamita. Sujata was not like Bala. Personality, virtue, intelligence, and talent varied widely among people. The path of liberation that the Buddha had discovered needed to be expounded in many ways to suit many kinds of people. Teaching the village children was so pleasant, he thought, because he could speak to them in such a simple way. Different teaching methods were like gates by which different kinds of people could enter and understand the teaching. The creation of Dharma gates would result from direct encounters with people. There were no ready-made methods miraculously received under the Bodhi tree. The Buddha saw that it would be necessary to return to society in order to set the wheel of Dharma in motion and to sow the seeds of liberation. 49 days had passed since his awakening. It was now time to depart from Uruvela. He decided to leave the following morning, parting from the cool forest by the banks of the Naranjara River, the Bodhi tree, and the children. He wanted first to seek out his two teachers, Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. He was confident that they would attain awakening in no time at all. After assisting these two venerable men, he would find the five friends who had practiced austerities with him. Then he would return to Magadha to see King Bimbisara. The next morning the Buddha put on his new robe and walked into Uruvela while the morning air was still misty. He went to Svasti's hut and told the young buffalo boy and his family that the time had come for him to depart. The Buddha patted each of the children gently on the head, and together they walked to Sujata's house. Sujata cried when she learned the news. The Buddha said, "I must leave in order to fulfill my responsibilities, but I promise that I will return to visit you whenever I have a chance. You children have helped me greatly, and I am grateful. Please remember and practice the things I've shared with you. That way I will never be far from you. Sujata, dry your tears now and give me a smile." Sujata wiped her tears with the edge of her sari and tried to smile. Then the children walked with the Buddha to the edge of the village. The Buddha was turning to say farewell when he noticed a young ascetic walking toward them. The ascetic joined his palms in greeting and looked curiously at the Buddha. After a long moment, he said, "Monk, you look most radiant and peaceful. What is your name and who is your master?" The Buddha answered, "My name is Siddhartha Gautama. I have studied with many teachers, but no one is my teacher now. What is your name and where are you coming from?" The ascetic answered, "My name is Upaka. I have just left the center of Master Udaka Ramaputta. Is Master Udaka in good health?" "Master Udaka died just a few days ago." The Buddha sighed. He would not have a chance to help his old teacher after all. He asked, "Have you ever studied with Master Alara Kalama?" Upaka answered, "Yes, but he too has recently died. Do you by any chance know of a monk named Kondana? Upaka said, yes, indeed. I heard about Kondana and four other monks when I was living at Master Udaka's center. I heard they are living and practicing together at the deer park at Isipatana, near the city of Varanasi. Gautama, if you will excuse me, I will continue on my way. I have a long day's journey ahead. The Buddha joined his palms to bid Upaka farewell, and then he turned to the children. Children, I will follow the road to Varanasi to find my five friends. The sun has risen. Please return home now. The Buddha joined his palms in farewell. Then he followed the river northwards. He knew it would be a longer route, but easier to travel. The Naranjara River led northward to where it emptied into the Ganga. If he followed the westward course of the Ganga, he would reach the village of Pataligrama within a few days. There he could cross to the other side of the Ganga and reach Varanasi, the capital of Kasi. The children gazed at him until he was out of sight. They were filled with terrible sadness and longing. Sujata cried, and Svasti felt like crying too, but he did not want to cry in front of his brother and sisters. After a long moment, he said, Sister Sujata, I need to get ready to tend the buffaloes. We should all head home. Bala, remember to give Rupak a bath today. Here, I'll carry Bhima. They followed the riverbank toward the village. No one spoke another word. The elder Ananda was gentle and friendly, as well as unusually handsome, and he did indeed possess an uncanny memory. He remembered every detail of every discourse the Buddha gave. He repeated the 11 points the Buddha had elaborated in the Sutra on tending water buffaloes to Svasti and Rahula's gratitude. Svasti realized that Ananda would remember everything Svasti had just recounted about the Buddha's time in the forest near Uruvela. While Svasti recounted his story, he glanced often at Bhikkhuni Gotami. Her sparkling eyes told him how much she enjoyed listening to all he was saying. He made a special effort to include as many details as he could remember. Bhikkhuni Gotami especially enjoyed hearing about all the children in Uruvela, like the time they ate tangerines mindfully with the Buddha in the forest. It was easy to see how much Rahula enjoyed hearing what Svasti had to say. Although the elder Asaji had not made any comments during the 2 days Svasti told his story, it was clear he was enjoying it also. Svasti knew that Asaji was one of the five friends who had practiced self-mortification with the Buddha. Svasti was most curious to know what happened when the Buddha met them after 6 months of separation, but he was too shy to ask. As if she could read his thoughts, Bhikkhuni Gotami said, Svasti, would you like to hear the elder Asaji tell us what happened after the Buddha left Uruvela? Asaji has been with the Buddha for 10 years now, but I don't think he has ever spoken about what happened in the deer park at Isipatana. Master Asaji, would you consent to tell us about the Buddha's first Dharma talk and some of what has taken place in the past 10 years? Asaji joined his palms and responded, No need to call me Master, Bhikkhuni Gotami. Today we have already heard a great deal from Bhikkhu Svasti, and it is almost time for meditation. Why don't you all come to my hut tomorrow, and I will tell you all that I remember. Chapter 22 Turning the Wheel of Dharma. Asaji was practicing the austere way in the deer park. One day after a sitting meditation, he noticed a monk approaching from off in the distance. As the stranger came closer, he realized it was none other than Siddhartha, and he quickly told his four friends. Bhadia said, Siddhartha abandoned the path halfway. He ate rice, drank milk, and visited the village children. He really let us down. I say we shouldn't even greet him. So the five friends agreed not to meet Siddhartha by the gate to the park. They also decided not to stand and greet him if he should enter the deer park by himself. But what actually took place was entirely different. When Siddhartha entered the gate, the five ascetic companions were so impressed by his radiant bearing that they all stood up at once. Siddhartha seemed to be surrounded by an aura of light. Each step he took revealed a rare spiritual strength. His penetrating gaze undermined their intention to snub him. Kondana ran up to him and took his begging bowl. Mahanama fetched water so that Siddhartha could wash his hands and feet. Badia pulled up a stool for him to sit on. Vapa found a fan of palm leaves and began to fan him. Asaji stood to one side, not knowing what to do. After Siddhartha washed his hands and feet, Asaji realized he could fill a bowl with cool water and offer it to him. The five friends sat in a circle around Siddhartha, who looked kindly at them and said, "My brothers, I have found the way, and I will show it to you." Asaji half believed and half doubted Siddhartha's words. Perhaps the others felt the same, for no one spoke for a long moment. Then Kondana blurted out, "Gautama, you abandoned the path halfway. You ate rice, drank milk, and spent time with the village children. How can you have found the path to liberation?" Siddhartha looked into Kondana's eyes and asked, "Friend Kondana, you have known me a long time. During all that time, have I ever lied to you?" Kondana admitted that he had not. "Indeed, Siddhartha, I have never heard you speak anything but the truth." The Buddha said, "Then please listen, my friends. I have found the great way, and I will show it to you. You will be the first to hear my teaching. This Dharma is not the result of thinking. It is the fruit of direct experience. Listen serenely with all your awareness." The Buddha's voice was filled with such spiritual authority that his five friends joined their palms and looked up at him. Kondana spoke for them all. "Please, friend Gautama, show us compassion and teach us the way." The Buddha began serenely. "My brothers, there are two extremes that a person on the path should avoid. One is to plunge oneself into sensual pleasures, and the other is to practice austerities which deprive the body of its needs. Both of these extremes lead to failure. The path I have discovered is the middle way, which avoids both extremes and has the capacity to lead one to understanding, liberation, and peace. It is the noble eightfold path of right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. I have followed this noble eightfold path and have realized understanding, liberation, and peace. Brothers, why do I call this path the right path? I call it the right path because it does not avoid or deny suffering, but allows for a direct confrontation with suffering as the means to overcome it. The Noble Eightfold Path is the path of living in awareness. Mindfulness is the foundation. By practicing mindfulness, you can develop concentration, which enables you to attain understanding. Thanks to right concentration, you realize right awareness, thoughts, speech, action, livelihood, and effort. The understanding that develops can liberate you from every shackle of suffering and give birth to true peace and joy. Brothers, there are four truths: the existence of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. I call these the four noble truths. The first is the existence of suffering. Birth, old age, sickness, and death are suffering. Sadness, anger, jealousy, worry, anxiety, fear, and despair are suffering. Separation from loved ones is suffering. Association with those you hate is suffering. Desire, attachment, and clinging to the five aggregates are suffering. Brothers, the second truth is the cause of suffering. Because of ignorance, people cannot see the truth about life, and they become caught in the flames of desire, anger, jealousy, grief, worry, fear, and despair. Brothers, the third truth is the cessation of suffering. Understanding the truth of life brings about the cessation of every grief and sorrow and gives rise to peace and joy. Brothers, the fourth truth is the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. It is the Noble Eightfold Path, which I have just explained. The Noble Eightfold Path is nourished by living mindfully. Mindfulness leads to concentration and understanding, which liberates you from every pain and sorrow and leads to peace and joy. I will guide you along this path of realization. While Siddhartha was explaining the Four Noble Truths, Kondana suddenly felt a great light shining within his own heart. He could taste the liberation he had sought for so long. His face beamed with joy. The Buddha pointed at him and cried, "Kondana, you've got it! You've got it!" Kondana joined his palms and bowed before the Buddha. With deepest respect, he spoke, "Venerable Gautama, please accept me as your disciple. I know that under your guidance, I will attain the Great Awakening." The other four monks also bowed at the Buddha's feet, joined their palms, and asked to be received as disciples. The Buddha motioned his friends to rise. After they took their places again, he said, "Brothers, the children of Uruvela village gave me the name the Buddha. You too may call me by that name if you like." Kondana asked, "Doesn't Buddha mean one who is awakened?" "That is correct. And they call the path I have discovered the Way of Awakening. What do you think of this name?"
"One who is awakened. The Way of Awakening. Wonderful, wonderful. These names are true yet simple. We will happily call you the Buddha and the path you have discovered the Way of Awakening. As you just said, living each day mindfully is the very basis of spiritual practice."
The five monks were of one mind to accept Gautama as their teacher and to call him the Buddha. The Buddha smiled at them. "Please, brothers, practice with an open and intelligent spirit, and in 3 months you will have attained the fruit of liberation." The Buddha stayed in Isipatana to guide his five friends. Following his teaching, they gave up their practice of austerities. Every day, three monks went begging for food and returned to share the offerings with the other three. The Buddha gave them individual attention, enabling each monk to make rapid progress. The Buddha taught them about the impermanent and non-self nature of all things. He taught them to look at the five aggregates as five constantly flowing rivers, which contained nothing that could be called separate or permanent. The five aggregates were the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. By meditating on the five aggregates within themselves, they came to see the intimate and wondrous connection between themselves and all in the universe. Thanks to their diligence, they all realized the way. The first to attain awakening was Kondana, followed 2 months later by Vappa and Badiya. Shortly afterward, Mahanama and Asaji also attained arhatship. In great joy, the Buddha told them, "Now we have a real community, which we will call our Sangha. The Sangha is the community of those who live in harmony and awareness. We must take the seeds of awakening and sow them in all places." Chapter 23. Dharma Nectar. It was the Buddha's custom to rise early and to sit in meditation, and then do walking meditation among the forest trees. One morning, while walking, he saw a handsome, elegantly dressed man in his late 20s, half hidden in the morning mist. The Buddha sat on a large rock, and when the man approached quite close to the rock, still unaware of the Buddha, he mumbled, "Disgusting, repulsive." The Buddha spoke up, "There is nothing disgusting. There is nothing repulsive." The man stopped in his tracks. The Buddha's voice was clear and soothing, and the man looked up to see the Buddha sitting there, relaxed and serene. The young man removed his sandals and bowed deeply before the Buddha. Then he sat on a nearby rock. The Buddha asked, "What is so disgusting? What is so repulsive?" The young man introduced himself as Yasa, the son of one of the wealthiest and most reputable merchants in Varanasi. Yasa had always enjoyed a life of splendor and ease. His parents catered to his every whim, providing him with every kind of pleasure, including a handsome manor, jewels, money, wine, courtesans, banquets, and parties. But Yasa, a sensitive and thoughtful young man, had begun to feel suffocated by this life of pleasure and could no longer find any contentment in it. He was like a person locked in a room without windows. He longed for some fresh air, for a simple, wholesome life. The night before, Yasa and some friends had gathered to feast, drink, play music, and be entertained by lovely young courtesans. In the middle of the night, Yasa woke up and looked at his friends and the young women sprawled out asleep. At that moment, he knew he could not continue to behave that way. He threw a cloak over his body, slipped on a pair of sandals, and walked out the front gate, not even knowing where he would go. He had wandered aimlessly all night until by chance he found himself in the deer park of Isipatana. And now, as the sun rose, he sat facing the Buddha. the Buddha counseled him. Yasa, this life is filled with suffering, but it is also filled with many wonders. To drown in sensual pleasures is bad for the health of both body and mind. If you live simply and wholesomely, not ruled by desires, it is possible to experience the many wonders of life. Yasa, look around you. Can you see the trees standing in the morning mists? Are they not beautiful? The moon, the stars, the rivers, the mountains, the sunlight, the songs of birds, and the sounds of bubbling springs are all manifestations of a universe that can provide us with endless happiness. The happiness we receive from these things nourishes mind and body. Close your eyes and breathe in and out a few times. Now open them. What do you see? Trees, mist, sky, rays of sunlight. Your own two eyes are wonders. Because you have been out of touch with wonders like these, you have come to despise your mind and body. Some people despise their own minds and bodies so much they want to commit suicide. They see only the suffering in life. But suffering is not the true nature of the universe. Suffering is the result of the way we live and of our erroneous understanding of life. The Buddha's words touched Yasa like fresh drops of cool dew to soothe his parched heart. Overcome with happiness, he prostrated before the Buddha and asked to become a disciple. The Buddha helped him up and said, "A monk lives a simple and humble life. He has no money. He sleeps in a grass hut or beneath the trees. He eats only what he receives from begging, and he eats only one meal a day. Can you live such a life?" "Yes, Master. I would be happy to live such a life." The Buddha continued, "A monk devotes his mind and body to realize liberation in order to help himself and all others. He concentrates his efforts to help relieve suffering. Do you vow to follow such a path?" "Yes, Master, I vow to follow such a path." "Then I accept you as my disciple. A disciple in my community is known as a bhikkhu, a beggar. Every day you will go to beg your food in order to nourish yourself, to practice humility, and to be in touch with others in order to show them the way." Just then the Buddha's five friends and first disciples appeared. Yasa stood up and respectfully greeted each one. The Buddha introduced them to Yasa and then turned to Kondana. "Kondana, Yasa wishes to become a bhikkhu. I have accepted him. Please show him how to wear a robe, carry a begging bowl, observe his breath, and do sitting and walking meditation." Yasa bowed to the Buddha and then followed Kondana, who led him to his hut, where he shaved Yasa's hair and gave him instruction according to the Buddha's wishes. Kondana happened to have an extra robe and bowl, which had been offered to him but which he had never used. He gave these to Yasa. That afternoon, Yasa's father came looking for him. All morning long, the household had frantically been seeking Yasa at his father's orders. One servant followed Yasa's footprints to the deer park, and there he found Yasa's golden sandals abandoned by a large rock. After making inquiries, he learned that his young master was staying there with some monks. He returned in haste to inform Yasa's father. When Yasa's father arrived, he found the Buddha sitting serenely on a rock. He joined his palms and respectfully asked, "Revered monk, have you seen my son Yasa?" The Buddha motioned to a nearby rock and invited Yasa's father to be seated. He said, "Yasa is in the hut and will be out shortly." Yasa's father listened as the Buddha recounted all that had taken place that morning. The Buddha helped him understand Yasa's inner thoughts and aspirations. "Yasa is a bright and sensitive young man. He has found the path of liberation for his heart. He now has faith, peace, and joy. Please be happy for him," the Buddha said. The Buddha also told Yasa's father how it was possible to live in a way that could reduce suffering and anxiety and create peace and joy for oneself and all those around one. The merchant felt lighter with each word the Buddha spoke. He stood up and joined his palms together to ask to be accepted as a lay disciple. The Buddha was silent for a moment, and then he spoke, "My disciples strive to live simply with awareness, avoid killing, shun adultery, speak truthfully, and avoid alcohol and stimulants which cloud the mind. Sir, if you feel you can follow such a path, I will accept you as a lay disciple." Vyasa's father knelt before the Buddha and joined his palms. Allow me to take refuge in your teaching. Please show me the way in this life. I vow to remain faithful to your teaching all my days. The Buddha helped the merchant back to his feet. Vyasa joined them. He was clad in a bhikkhu's robe, and his head was shaven. The new bhikkhu smiled with rare joy. He joined his palms to make a lotus bud, and then bowed to his father. Vyasa looked radiant. His father had never seen him so happy. Vyasa's father bowed to his son and said, Your mother is at home, and she is very worried about you. Vyasa answered, I will visit her to relieve her worries. But I have taken vows to follow the Buddha and to live a life of service to all beings. Vyasa's father turned to the Buddha. Please, Master, allow me to invite you and your bhikkhus to have a meal at my house tomorrow. We would be deeply honored if you would come instruct us on the path of awakening. The Buddha turned and looked at Vyasa. The new bhikkhu's eyes sparkled. Then the Buddha nodded his acceptance. The following day, the Buddha and his six bhikkhus ate at the home of Vyasa's parents. Vyasa's mother wept, so overcome was she to see her son both safe and happy. The Buddha and his bhikkhus were invited to sit on cushioned chairs. Vyasa's mother served them herself. As the bhikkhus ate in silence, no one spoke, not even the household servants. When the meal was finished and the begging bowls had been washed, Vyasa's parents bowed to the Buddha and then sat on low stools placed before him. The Buddha taught them the five precepts, which formed the foundation of practice for lay disciples. The first precept is, do not kill. All living beings fear death. If we truly follow the path of understanding and love, we will observe this precept. Not only should we protect the lives of humans, we should protect the lives of animals as well. Observing this precept nourishes compassion and wisdom. The second precept is, do not steal. We do not have the right to steal the property of others, nor to gain wealth by taking advantage of the labor of others. We must find ways to help others support themselves. The third precept is, do not engage in sexual misconduct. Do not violate the rights and commitments of others. Always remain faithful to your spouse. The fourth precept is, do not say untruthful things. Do not utter words that distort the truth or cause discord and hatred. Do not spread news that you do not know to be certain. The fifth precept is, do not use alcohol or any other stimulants. If you live by the spirit of the five precepts, you will avoid suffering and discord for yourself, your family, and your friends. You will find your happiness in life multiplied many times over. As Vyasa's mother listened to the Buddha, she felt as though a gate of happiness had just opened in her heart. She was happy to know that her husband had already been accepted as a lay disciple by the Buddha. She knelt before the Buddha and joined her palms. She, too, was accepted as a lay disciple. The Buddha and his six bhikkhus returned to Isipatana. Chapter 24. Taking Refuge. News of Vyasa becoming a bhikkhu spread quickly among his friends. His closest companions, Vimala, Subahu, Punaji, and Gavampati, decided to visit him at Isipatana. On the way there, Subahu said, If Vyasa has decided to become a monk, his master must be really extraordinary, and the path he teaches most lofty. Vyasa is very discriminating. Vimala retorted, Don't be so certain. Perhaps he's become a monk on a whim, and it won't last long. After 6 months or a year, he may very well abandon such a life. Gavampati disagreed. You're not taking Vyasa seriously enough. I've always found him to be quite serious, and I'm sure he wouldn't do anything like this without sincerely intending it. When they found Vyasa at the deer park, he introduced them to the Buddha. Teacher, these four friends of mine are all fine persons. Please have compassion and open their eyes to the path of liberation. The Buddha sat down to talk with the four young men. At first, Vimala was the most skeptical, but the more he heard, the more impressed he became. Finally, he suggested to the other three that they all ask the Buddha to accept them as bhikkhus. The four young men knelt before the Buddha. Recognizing their sincerity, the Buddha accepted them on the spot. He asked Kondana to give them basic instruction. Yasa had several hundred other friends who soon heard how Yasa and his four closest companions had all become bhikkhus. 120 of these young men, all in their 20s, met outside Yasa's home and decided to visit Isipatana that very morning. Yasa was informed of their arrival, and he came out to greet them. He spoke about his decision to become a bhikkhu, and then he led them to have an audience with the Buddha. Surrounded by the young men, the Buddha spoke about the path which can end suffering and lead to peace and joy. He told them about his own search and how he had vowed to find the way while he was still a young man. The 120 young men listened as if entranced. 50 of them requested to become bhikkhus at once. Many of the other 70 also wanted to become bhikkhus, but could not abandon their responsibilities as sons, husbands, and fathers. Yasa asked the Buddha to accept his 50 friends, and the Buddha agreed. Overjoyed, Yasa said, "With your permission, tomorrow I will pass by my parents' home when I am out begging. I can ask them if they might like to offer robes and bowls to these new bhikkhus." The Buddha now had 60 bhikkhus living with him at the deer park. He remained there for 3 additional months in order to guide the community. During that time, several hundred men and women were accepted by the Buddha as lay disciples. The Buddha taught the bhikkhus how to practice observing their bodies, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. He taught them about the interdependent nature of all things and explained that meditating on interdependence was very important. He explained that all things depend on each other for their arising, development, and decline. Without dependent co-arising, nothing could exist. Within one thing existed all things. The meditation on dependent co-arising, he said, is a gate that leads to liberation from birth and death. It has the power to break through fixed and narrow views, such as the belief that the universe has been created either by some god or from some element such as earth, water, fire, or air. The Buddha understood his responsibility as a teacher. He cared for and guided the 60 bhikkhus like a loving elder brother. He also shared a lot of responsibility with his first 5 disciples. Kondana guided 20 young men, while Badiya, Vapa, Mahanama, and Asaji each helped guide 10 young men. All the bhikkhus made great progress along the path. When the Buddha saw this, he called the community together and said, "Bhikkhus, please listen. We are totally free, not bound by anything. You understand the path now. Proceed with confidence and you will make great strides. You can leave Isipatana whenever you like. Walk as free persons and share the way of awakening with others. Please sow the seeds of liberation and enlightenment to bring peace and joy to others. Teach the path of liberation, which is beautiful from beginning to end in form and content. Countless others will benefit from your work of spreading the Dharma. As for me, I will leave soon. I plan to head east. I want to visit the Bodhi tree and the children in Uruvela village. Afterward, I will go to visit a special friend in Rajagaha." After listening to the Buddha's words, a large number of bhikkhus, clad in brick-colored robes and carrying just their begging bowls, left to go spread the teaching. Only 20 bhikkhus remained in Isipatana. Before long, many people in the kingdoms of Kasi and Magadha heard about the Buddha and his disciples. They knew that a prince of the Sakya clan had attained liberation and was teaching his path in Isipatana, near the city of Varanasi. Many monks, who up to then had not yet attained the fruits of liberation, felt greatly encouraged, and they came from all directions to Isipatana. After hearing the Buddha speak, most took vows to become bhikkhus. The bhikkhus who had left Isipatana to spread the teaching brought back many more young men who also wished to become monks. The number of disciples soon swelled. One day the Buddha gathered the Sangha in the deer park and said, "Bhikkhus, it is no longer necessary for me personally to ordain every new bhikkhu or for everyone who wishes to be ordained to come to Isipatana. Those who wish to receive ordination should be able to do so in their own villages, in the presence of their friends and families. And like you, I too would like to be free to remain here and to travel from here. Henceforth, when you meet a sincere and aspiring new bhikkhu, you may ordain him wherever you may be." Kondana stood up and joined his palms. "Master, please show us the way to organize a ceremony of ordination. Then we can do it by ourselves in the future." The Buddha answered, "Please do as I have done in the past." Asaji stood up and said, "Master, your presence is so formidable, you do not need to perform a formal ceremony. But for the rest of us, a formal procedure is needed. Brother Kondana, perhaps you can suggest a form. The Buddha is here with us, and he can add to your suggestions." Kondana was silent for a moment. Then he spoke. "Respected Buddha, I think the first step should be to have the aspiring bhikkhu allow his hair and beard to be shaved. Then he can be instructed in the manner of wearing the robe. After he has put on his robe, he can expose his right shoulder in the customary manner and kneel before the monk giving the ordination. It is proper to kneel as the monk giving the ordination is serving as the representative of the Buddha. The one being ordained can hold his palms together like a lotus bud and recite 3 times, 'I take refuge in the Buddha, the one who shows me the way in this life. I take refuge in the Dharma, the way of understanding and love. I take refuge in the Sangha, the community that lives in harmony and awareness.' After repeating these refuges, he will be considered a bhikkhu in the community of the Buddha. But this is only my poor suggestion. Please, teacher, correct it." The Buddha answered, "It is most fine. Brother Kondana, reciting the 3 refuges 3 times while kneeling before an already ordained bhikkhu shall be sufficient to become an ordained bhikkhu." The community was happy with this decision. A few days later, the Buddha put on his robe, lifted his bowl, and left Isipatana on his own. It was an especially beautiful morning. He headed toward the Ganga River to return to Mogata. Chapter 25. Music's Lofty Peaks. The Buddha had traveled the road from Varanasi to Rajagaha before. He walked slowly and enjoyed the surrounding forests and rice fields. Toward noon, he stopped to beg in a small hamlet by the roadside. He then entered the forest to eat quietly, and then did walking meditation right there. When he was finished, he sat beneath a shady tree to meditate. He enjoyed being alone in the forest. After he had meditated for some hours, a group of well-dressed young men passed by, obviously agitated over something. Several of them clutched musical instruments. The young man at the head of their party bowed his head to greet the Buddha and then asked, "Monk, did you see a girl run by here?" The Buddha asked, "Why do you wish to find her?" The young man recounted their story from the beginning. They were from the city of Varanasi and had entered the forest that morning on a pleasure outing, bringing with them their musical instruments and a young woman to entertain them. When they had finished singing, dancing, and feasting, they stretched out on the forest floor to take a nap. But when they awoke, they discovered that the young girl had stolen their jewelry and disappeared. They had been chasing after her ever since. The Buddha looked calmly at the young men and asked, "Tell me, friends, is it better in this moment to find the young woman or to find your own selves?" The young men were startled. The Buddha's radiant appearance and his unusual question brought them back to themselves. The first young man answered, "Respected teacher, perhaps we should try to find ourselves first." The Buddha said, "Life can be found only in the present moment, but our minds rarely dwell in the present moment. Instead, we chase after the past or long for the future. We think we are being ourselves, but in fact, we almost never are in real contact with ourselves. Our minds are too busy chasing after yesterday's memories or tomorrow's dreams. The only way to be in touch with life is to return to the present moment. Once you know how to return to the present moment, you'll become awakened, and at that moment you will find your true self. Look at these tender leaves caressed by the sunlight. Have you ever really looked at the green of the leaves with a serene and awakened heart? This shade of green is one of the wonders of life. If you have never really looked at it, please do so now." The young men grew very quiet. With their eyes following the Buddha's pointing finger, each of them looked at the green leaves gently swaying in the afternoon breeze. A moment later, the Buddha turned to the youth sitting on his right and said, "I see you have a flute. Please play something for us." The youth felt shy, but he lifted his flute to his lips and began to play. Everyone listened attentively. The flute's sound was like the lamenting cry of a disappointed lover. The Buddha's eyes did not waver from the young man playing the flute. When he finished his song, sadness seemed to veil the afternoon forest. Still no one spoke, until suddenly the young man held out his flute to the Buddha and said, "Respected monk, please play for us." The Buddha smiled as several of the young men burst out laughing, taking their friend for a real fool. Who ever heard of a monk playing the flute? But to their surprise, the Buddha took the flute in his hands. The young men all turned their eyes to the Buddha, unable to mask their curiosity. The Buddha took several deep breaths and then raised the flute to his lips. The image of a young man playing the flute long ago in the royal gardens of Kapilavatthu arose in the Buddha's mind. It was a full moon night. He could see Mahapajapati sitting on a stone bench, quietly listening. And there was Yasodhara with her freshly lit incense holder of fragrant sandalwood. The Buddha began to play the flute. The sound was as delicate as a thin strand of smoke curling gently from the roof of a simple dwelling outside Kapilavatthu at the hour of the evening meal. Slowly the thin strand expanded across space like a gathering of clouds, which in turn transformed into a thousand-petaled lotus, each petal a different shimmering color. It seemed that one flutist suddenly had become 10,000 flutists, and all the wonders of the universe had been transformed into sounds, sounds of a thousand colors and forms, sounds as light as a breeze and quick as the pattering of rain, clear as a crane flying overhead, intimate as a lullaby, bright as a shining jewel, and subtle as the smile of one who has transcended all thoughts of gain and loss. The birds of the forest stopped singing in order to listen to this sublime music, and even the breezes ceased rustling the leaves. The forest was enveloped in an atmosphere of total peace, serenity, and wonder. The young men sitting around the Buddha felt completely refreshed, and they now dwelled completely in the present moment, in touch with all the wonders of the trees, the Buddha, the flute, and each other's friendship. Even after the Buddha put the flute down, they could still hear the music. Not one of the young men thought about the young woman or the jewels she had stolen. No one spoke for a long time. Then the young man to whom the flute belonged asked the Buddha, "Master, you play so wonderfully. I've never heard anyone who could play so well. Who did you study with? Would you accept me as your student so that I could learn flute from you?" The Buddha smiled, and he said, "I learned to play the flute when I was a boy, but I have not played in nearly 7 years. My sound, however, is better than it was before." "How can that be, Master? How can your playing have improved if you have not practiced in 7 years?" "Playing the flute does not depend solely on practicing the flute. I now play better than in the past because I have found my true self. You cannot reach lofty heights in art if you do not first discover the unsurpassable beauty in your own heart. If you would like to play the flute truly well, you must find your true self on the path of awakening." The Buddha explained the path of liberation, the Four Noble Truths, and the Noble Eightfold Path. The young men listened intently, and when the Buddha was finished speaking, every one of them knelt down and asked to be accepted as a disciple. The Buddha ordained them all. He then instructed them to make their way to Isipatthana and introduce themselves to the Bhikkhu Kondana, who would give them guidance in the practice of the way. The Buddha told them he would see them again before long. That night, the Buddha slept alone in the forest. The next morning, he crossed the Ganga and headed east. He wanted to visit the children of Uruvela before making his way to Rajagaha to see King Bimbisara.